Well, greetings, greetings, and welcome to the show. This is Wrong Place, Right Crime, Takeover by Mysteries to Die For. I am your co-host, T.G. Wolf.
And I am your other co-host, Jack Wolf. Our podcast, Mysteries to Die For, is storytelling whodunit mysteries. A Checkered Past by Frank Zaffiro dropped as Season 7, Episode 6 in March. So we thought we'd take over his podcast and ask him the questions everyone is dying to know. So Frank, welcome to your show.
Well, thanks for having me.
We really appreciate you making the time to talk to us. So we're going to start out with a meatball question here. A Checkered Past is a Stefan Kopriva story. So the first question is, how do you say his name correctly?
You just did.
I did. I nailed it. Did.
Yeah. I mean, it's the anglicized version of the Czech. The Czech would be different.
Let's say it in Czech.
Oh, boy, it's been a long time since I've spoken Czech every day. So Stefan would still be Stefan. Or it would be Stefan, I guess. Stefan. And then Kopriva, if I'm not mistaken, has a hot Czech R in it, which is a little hook over the top of the letter. Yeah. So like if it's over a C, it goes from the ts sound to the ch sound. And the S, it goes from the S sound to the sh. It's kind of like adding an H, I guess, in a lot of cases. But the R is weird. It's like a zhr. Oh. So it'd be like Kopriva, you know.
Oh, I rolled it like in Italian. I said Kopriva.
That's probably as close as you can.
I channeled my Anona, who would say Atina. Oh, why you know eat more? A Stefan Kopriva.
That works. That really works. You know, I mean, you know, names get anglicized. I mean, my real last name is Scalise, but I mean, in the old country, that would be Scalise. So, you know, there was a big push for a long time when people came to this country to Americanize their names and their, you know, to fit in and so forth. And so I think a lot of folks saw their names get pronounced differently.
Family lived that life. So the G in TG Wolf stands for Gianmarco, which I believe is actually pronounced Gianmarco. My brother is a firefighter, and when he answers the phone, he says Gianmarco, and a lot of his coworkers thought his name was Jim Marco.
yeah, it's, you know, I don't think I've told anybody this, the name. So, you know, the reason I like Czech, obviously, is I was a Czech linguist in the Army for 5 years in military intelligence right out of high school, which sounds sexier than it was. But, you know, I did learn Czech, and I did become fluent in it over the course of 15 months and was for a few years there. But language is a perishable skill. And after I came on the job years later, I was on patrol, and I stopped a car one time because he had picked up a prostitute. And the prostitute in the car, her last name was Kopriva. And I was like, oh, that's a cool name. It's a Czech name. I knew it was Czech. I told her, oh, your name's Czech. And she's argued with me. She said, no, it wasn't. It was American. So I just kind of filed that away because I thought it was a cool name. And when it came time to write the River City series and to put the characters together, that was the name I chose for Steph.
That's pretty interesting. I can't say that I've ever named a character after a prostitute, but I will take note. All right. Our next question is, you write gritty crime by your own definition. Your stories are very rooted in human stories, real stories, unlike my Detective Connolly. So what is it about your professional past that influences you to write gritty crime?
That's a good question. I think there's really two answers to that. The cop-out answer that is probably still true.
Punny cop.
Exactly. Is, you know, that's the nature of the stories that come to mind. You know, I'm just being true to the vision that of what, you know, I'm inspired to write. But going a little deeper, I think it's, you know, when I was on the job and even still today, one of the things that, you know, that I really am concerned about is being understood, and law enforcement's a misunderstood profession. And of course we do a lot to help further that misunderstanding, unfortunately. And so I wanted to, you know, to put a human face on the characters, in the River City series, but I also wanted it to be realistic in terms of what officers faced on a daily basis, not the more overblown, you know, diehard type of thing, but something rooted in realism. And so that's how I wrote the River City series. And since Steph was in River City as a cop and eventually spun off on his own series, it just not only did that ethos kind of, or ethos, I guess it is the right way to say it, follow him into that series, but I actually could go even deeper because, you know, he was no longer on the job, so he could do things that he would never have thought to do as a police officer.
So kind of building on that, we had a question that said, you know, cops get a lot of hate and criticism in a lot of places, and whether you use these stories to push back on that. But I guess after what you said, my question now is, you know, do you use it as a tool for, like you said, showing the other side? But do you have to hold yourself back from heroizing things or exaggerating them to kind of balance out, you know, the noise of what is out there?
No, I don't think so. I don't, you know, the creed for River City was always that the good guys usually win, but not always, and never without a cost. And so when that's kind of your code, you know, ramping things up to, you know, near superhero levels of heroism to counteract, you know, other narratives that are out there just doesn't work. And I think people, you know, call BS on that kind of stuff. I mean, they might enjoy it for pure entertainment purposes, but it doesn't necessarily resonate with them when it's so far to one side or the other in terms of a viewpoint. And, you know, that's a whole other tangent, but I think there's so much polarization and so much of a lack of nuance that even though that is a lot of what's out in the public, you know, discussion, the public discourse, most people's, you know, BS meter is tuned fairly well. And so, you know, if that's your agenda and you're building people up beyond what's realistic, you know, their meter beeps, it goes off, and then, yeah, maybe they'll still enjoy the story on an entertainment level, but will it touch them on a deeper personal level, which, you know, which you want with good art, that's what you want, right?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree in that. I think it heavily differs from the stuff that we end up writing. I know Diamond, TG's character, will just blow up a warehouse if she thinks it's fun. So, you know, in that regard, it's very different. So it's very cool to see how someone like you with experience in that field would want to create a character who's more realistic in that and in the same strand, both inform and entertain the general public on that sort of, you know, viewpoint and that sort of character.
At the same time, though, I mean, you know, those kind of books that are fun are fun, and you know, there's all kinds of things people turn to entertainment for, and some of it is not to be thinking about social issues or to be thinking about serious things. Sometimes they just want, you know, to be entertained and to enjoy themselves. I mean, people don't read the Stephanie Plum books or your Diamond books, you know, for. You know, realism, it's pure escape. And that's what you deliver for them is fun escape. And so I think there's a huge benefit to that as well. I just don't know if I'm the right person to deliver that, you know, so.
Well, I think every writer comes from their own field of expertise. And sometimes that field changes with age or experience. I could never write the way you do. I grew up in an engineering world where things are pretty much black and white and there are lots of puzzles to figure out, but that human element doesn't exist on the level that cops have to deal with it. So while Diamond does do some fairly outrageous things, I personally went to extra levels to try to make sure that they were bound by the laws of physics, not by the laws of man. And so it is an interesting point. And Jack, so your writing takes on a totally different realm. You don't have Frank's background as a cop or mine as an engineer.
I have my background as a child. It's pretty great, honestly.
You're a musician too. I mean, that has to. I mean, that's a big part of who you are, right? So it has to inform the other types of art that come from you.
Yeah, it's definitely that need to, maybe not need, but the want to entertain in that. You know, I forget who it was that said it. It might have been Dave Chappelle, but he said something along the sides of most comedians are musicians, and most musicians think they're funny. And so I really like that line, because I think that definitely entails me. I'm a musician, and I definitely like to think I'm funny in some regard or another. And I think that reflects in, you know, Detective Connolly, who does just the stupidest things for no real apparent reason.
So I was really fascinated that you were a linguist. How did you get that job? And you said it wasn't as sexy as it sounded, because that sounds like really freaking cool.
Well, the language part, if you're a language nerd, which, you know, I definitely was, it was great. I mean, they send you to the Defense Language Institute, which is in Monterey, California, which is a beautiful area. For me, it was for a year for Czech and 15 weeks after that for Slovak, the add-on. So I'm there for 15 months. I'm sorry, it's an 8-week add-on. 15 months total with vacation and stuff. And all you do is get up and go to school and learn how to speak one particular language. You go to, you know, grammar class, you go to conversation class, you go to, you know, all this stuff. I mean, it can be a grind like anything, but it was like as close to going to college while in the military that you're ever going to get. I mean, we still had PT, we still had common skills task training every Thursday or whatever it was, but, you know, it was much, much better than some of the other stuff you go through in the military. The process of getting picked for it is weird. They send you to take this test, and I think they still use it, a version of it called the Defense Language Aptitude Battery.
I thought you were going to say Defense Against the Dark Arts.
Well, it's about as convoluted. And it's a, you know, it's an aptitude test. So they don't care if you speak another language or not. What they do is they take English and they change a rule. So you'll, like, the first section will be like, okay, for this section, all adjectives must follow the nouns. So instead of saying, I see the White House, you say, I see the house white. Oh, that's easy, man. You know, so you do that. Then for this one, you know, the endings of the adjective and the noun have to match. So if you say, I see the blue donkey, it has to be, I see the bluey donkey, you know. And then, oh, don't forget, it has to follow. So it's actually, I see the donkey bluey, you know, and pretty soon, I mean, as it progresses, and this is all audio, it's not written, like you've got A, B, C, D bubbles in front of you, but it's all on tape. It's all from listening, not reading. And so, you know, the deeper you get into the test, you're just hearing a bunch of mishmashed English sounding words, you know, essentially, and having to pick out what the right combination is for the rule set that you've been given.
They make you match the gender of the article to the word, even though the word has no gender, because that's a thing.
Yeah. 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 They, because a lot of languages are genderized, and some languages have neuter genders like German does. But they mess with you, totally mess with you. And then that was like 3/4 of the test. There's a one last quarter of it was testing pictograph capabilities. You know, they'd say, you know, what's the closest pictograph to the sentence, you know, the dog bit the man on the leg. And then they'd have 4 pictures, none of which were exactly a match, and you'd have to pick which one. And I think I bombed that part of it. I'm just not, you know, my spatial relations are not great. And I think for whatever reason, I didn't do well on that. But I know I did well on the grammar portion, because I got a really good score overall on the test. And, you know, the Army does a lot of dumb things, but, you know, they eventually stuck me in a language that was a very grammar-intensive language, and that seems to match up pretty well with where my strengths were on the test. Of course, when you sign up, they tell you, we guarantee your job, and because of what you scored on the test, we'll guarantee your language. You have to pick 7 languages from list A and 5 languages from list B, you know, and you have this illusion of choice. And so I picked all these languages and everything. And the very last one I picked, number 7 on the list of 7, was Czech because I ran out of other languages. Like I chose Japanese, I chose Russian, I chose German, France, you know, all these other ones. And then Czech, of course, is what I got. But that was because we were still, you know, in the midst of the Cold War and they needed Czech linguists. So, here's the other thing that's kind of funny. So 15 months at DLI, you know, after basic training, you know, learning a language test, like many of my colleagues, to the fluency level of a high school graduate native speaker. That was the goal. And then they send you to, in my case, to Goodfellow Air Force Base in Texas for about 16 weeks of top secret. You know, this is what your real job will be, training. And then they send you to your permanent duty station. Well, they sent me to Germany and they sent me to a unit that did not have an active Czech mission to intercept, right? That's what I was. I was an interceptor, put on headphones like the ones I'm wearing now and scroll through the frequencies looking for the military talking over the air and intercept their communications and, you know, try to gain intelligence from that, right? Well, the first unit I went to, they did not have an active intercept mission at all, not even an intercept mission, much less a Czech one. So I had to immediately cross train to be an analyst because they did have, that was their primary mission, was analyst. So I, 26 months of enlistment on a 48-month term to train for a job that they then cross trained me to do something else. That's the Army for you.
Well, yeah.
And you said that's not entertaining. That was endlessly entertaining.
Yeah, I was trying not to laugh too hard. All right. Well, we know all about your professional life now, so let's turn to your personal life. Hockey was featured in several Steph Kopriva stories. So are you a hockey player? And how many fights did you watch in slow motion to descript the...
Describe?
I'm reading descript. How many fights did you watch in slow motion to descript the hockey throwdowns in Fire for Fighting and Murder Misconduct?
There were some really awesomely described fight scenes. Having two boys who played hockey, and now that fighting is routinely part of our high school hockey night, I was like, wow, that's a really accurate description of a hockey fight.
Well, I came to hockey pretty late in life. I was like 29 when I started skating, and only a couple of years prior to that did I really start watching, you know, like maybe 92, 93, 94 in there is where I started watching it pretty consistently. And around 98 or so, finally landed on a favorite team, you know.
Which is?
Go Flyers.
Oh, it's Blackhawks for us.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a bummer.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good rivalry there. Good story there. Mm-hmm. You know, I started playing, and you know, when you're 29 years old and you start something as complicated as hockey, you're only ever going to be so good. You know, and I was not very good, you know, for a long time, and I only ever got to be like a C level recreational player, nothing fancy. But you know, I watched a ton of hockey. I mean, once I became a Flyers fan, and could get the hockey package, you know. I was an 82 or hopefully more game a year fan, you know. And the thing I love about it, one of the many things, is if you follow a team, and this is true in any sport, it's like a novel every year, you know. I mean, there's a different storyline and there are different subplots and everything. And it's fascinating to be part of that in real time. And so, I mean, you know, it's been a tragedy for much of the past decade, but for me, but it's been good. And because I've watched so much hockey, you know, describing a hockey fight was as easy as, you know, describing a boxing match or a street fight.
Yeah, I have to say, we got the same thing as Blackhawks fans. We got that stretch where we got like half a dozen Stanley Cups, and then now we're like the third worst team on the league. And
it was like three Stanley Cups. And
yeah. Well, tomato, potato, what's the difference?
About three cups. Which is, to be fair, three more cups than the Flyers have won since 75. Yeah.
Granted, as a child growing up watching that, it made me very cocky, thinking the Blackhawks were the greatest team on the world. And now you tell your friend, I like Blackhawks. And he's like, ah, they suck. I was like, well, they didn't when I liked them. So shut up. I'm better.
Now, I can barely skate. I did a couple mommy and me skating lessons when Jack and his brother were little. So I guess I got a question for both you. And since you've skated and you've played, doesn't it amp up the amount of respect or at least the amount of impressiveness that when you see guys at that highest level and what they do on skates, how fast and how nimble. Like, I can only have a sliver of an appreciation for it because, you know, I can barely stand up on skates.
Yeah, but it also makes me that much more angrier when I see someone do something stupid.
Yeah, I don't think I ever reached a point where I could be critical in that way, talent-wise. But you're absolutely right. I mean, when you know how hard it is just to skate, much less to do something while you're skating, for me, it's like musicians, to be honest with you. I mean, I've always admired musicians like anyone else and enjoyed music. And, you know, kind of, you know, if you watch somebody go on a guitar solo or whatever, you're like, wow, that's cool. And then I picked up a guitar, and for a non-musical background person, music is hard. You know, it's joyful, it's wonderful, but it's very hard, especially for someone with not a lot of rhythm. And so then you watch somebody play even a simple solo by professional standards and you're awestruck. And so, you know, I mean, it's the same way with hockey for me. Guys that are playing in the East Coast Hockey League are, you know, impressive as hell. I mean, the people in the NHL are, you know, the worst player in the NHL is still one of the 750 best players in the world, probably, you know.
No, that's a good point about the music. I don't know if your listeners have heard Mysteries to Die For, but Jack plays the piano throughout our entire episode. And then I expect him to be able to solve a mystery as he's been listening with one ear. And people who have come up to me and said something who are musicians are like, how does he do that? I'm like, I really don't know. It is impressive.
I do have to give credit to the deliberation at the end. There are multiple times that I have no idea what the story was even about until I get to the end and you explain the entire thing to me. And then I try and figure it out. I've done that on more occasions than I should. But no, a lot of times it's not as hard as you think it would be. And a lot of times if you listen to my music, you realize I'm not actually playing anything that hard. I'm just kind of spacing out, playing the same four chords for half an hour.
I mean, I'm a total, like, I looked at a video, you know, how to tell if you're an intermediate guitar player or not. And I think I got a C, so I must not be even intermediate. But, you know, I mean, I could go, you know, G, D, C, E minor and to carry on a conversation. And so I see what you're saying there. I think the real talent is it doesn't seem like that's what you're doing. And if I was doing that on a guitar, it would sound very robotic, whereas it's very flowing and it sounds quite like it fits the mute, you know, the actions that are going on. And maybe some of that's Tina's reading as well. But that's the real talent, I think, is making easy not look easy.
Well, if you just play jazz, all I remember is the worse you play, the better you play. Because if you play a note and no one understands why you play it, they think you know why you played it. So they think you're just a genius. I just played a wrong note. I didn't even know that note was on the keyboard. I forgot about it.
Yeah, not a jazz fan.
I like jazz. We were listening to a Hiatus Coyote, and I don't think they're very jazzy, but we listened to a piece that has like four different time signatures in it playing at the same time, and it's crazy, but... Yeah, no, jazz is not my thing. And jazz theory is something beyond my comprehension and many other rocket scientists. It's insane.
So wrapping this back around to fighting, I'm currently sort of working my way through all of the stuff universe, although I did not start with River City. So what's his last book?
Hope Dies Last.
No, I have the box set. What's the last one in the box
set? Friend of the Departed is the third book.
So Friend of the Departed, which starts with a bar fight.
Yes.
So I hear what you're saying about the hockey fight, but I just had to wonder, how many fights have you been in? Is this firsthand experience? Is it, okay, you weren't in the fights, but as a cop, you saw a heck of a lot of fights. Like, it just seems too spot on accurate to be a pure work of imagination.
You know, it's an amalgam of different types of personal experience, observations, and, you know, having watched TV and film too, for what works dramatically. You know, I started in karate when I was about 15, and the system that I trained in and the dojo that I was at put an emphasis on sparring, not an overly, you know, unbalanced one, but like we would have Monday, Wednesday, Friday classes, and Wednesday would be sparring, you know, and then Monday and Friday would be other stuff. And then Saturday was kind of, you never knew what you're going to get on Saturday. It was like an optional day. And when you fight essentially all the time, you learn a lot of different things about body mechanics and about what works and about that sort of thing. And then when you are in a real fight, you learn what works and what doesn't and how people react and so forth. And then, you know, I was a boxing fan, so, I throw that into the mix, throw martial arts movies and all the fighting you see in the movies into the mix. And then, I was on the job for 20 years and gotten plenty of fights there. Although most of those were more about someone trying to get away or not be taken into custody. I would say only about a quarter of them were actually like you see in the TV where, they're directing all their force at you and trying to kick your butt. Most of the time, they're trying to avoid being captured in some way. Now, they may direct force towards you in that process, but that's not their goal is to get away or to not be taken into custody anyway, in order to make it as hard as possible. And so you throw all of those things into a blender, and that's, what I'm able to draw upon to write those kinds of scenes.
You know, I'm remembering a scene in the second Steph, the Deep, Dark, and Lovely.
Lovely, dark, and Deep. Yeah, you got them all in there, just the wrong order. Yeah,
just the wrong order. Where I think it was that book that, Steph's in a fight, and he's has that internal dialogue going where he's like, I've been in fights before. I think he got his butt kicked in this one. And then he's kind of setting it in his mind going, but wait, when I was in fights before, it was exactly what you just said, that people were trying to get away from him. And he was the position of authority. And often they were people that had his back. Mm-hmm. And this is maybe not the first time, but he's alone. Mm-hmm. And the aggression is at him. Mm-hmm. And it was a very introspective moment for the character of realizing that, hey, I thought I'd been in fights. This is different.
And he, he gets his butt kicked occasionally, maybe more often than not. Well, and you and I are of an age, I think. And so you probably remember the Rockford Files on TV.
I do.
Maybe Jack knows them through the beauty of streaming.
Nope.
Not yet. He will.
If for no other reason than just the TV theme, the intro credits would be worth a watch because it's one of the best TV theme songs from that era.
Oh, now you hooked them.
it really is. I mean, it'd be in my top 10 for TV themes like before the golden age of television started, the onset of like The Sopranos or whatever. But the thing about Jim Rockford was, like, he was tough, but he was tough in a real way. Like, he wasn't look at it from a hockey perspective, maybe. Like, he's the guy that is not afraid to drop the gloves, even if he knows he's going to get his ass handed to him, right? He'll still drop them. And that was kind of Jim Rockford. Like, he wasn't afraid to fight, and he sometimes got beat and took a beating. And it was realistic in that way. And you never saw that on other shows. All the other times, either the bad guy would hit the hero on the head and knock him out, or the hero would win the fight, And so when I was writing the Kopriva series, I wanted that to be realistic and that you're not going to win every fight you ever get in. And Kopriva's not a huge guy. He's average to slightly less than average in height and build. And he has a few equalizers in that he had the police training and he had some martial arts training, but he's not training now. He's not currently training,
And he's got a bad leg.
And yeah, he's got the bad knee from getting shot up at the shootout at the Circle K and a bad shoulder from that as well. And then things get even worse for him later in the series, as you'll discover. And so, to have him win every single fight was just, I thought, stupid, and having him have to nurse himself through the injuries and to be realistic about whether he's going to win the fight or not, but still have to engage in the fight. That takes a certain kind of courage, much like, the guy who drops the gloves and goes up against somebody 20 pounds and 4 inches, bigger and taller, it takes a certain kind of courage to do that. And that's the one thing Stefan Kopriva does not lack is courage and tenacity. Those are traits that he does have despite his failings.
A shootout at a Circle K. That makes me want to write a scene about a bombing at a Chuck E. Cheese. Something about it.
No, children. Children are at Chuck E. Cheese.
After hours. No. After hours.
Yeah. They're fighting Chuck.
The animatronic Chuck you see mouse parts flying through the air.
People own those. When they shut down, people will buy the Chuck E. Cheese. That is terrifying. I don't want that in my house. It's terrifying.
So, Frank, we were checking out your website, and we have a bet going. What's the over-under on the number of projects you have going on? 8,000?
Take the under on that number. You mean in progress right now?
Well, sort of, because we were exploring your website and it turns out that you have a wizard name, Frank Seferio.
Oh, I do have a pen name for fantasy and science fiction.
Are you doing much on that front?
I've got a pretty good set of notes on the fantasy books. It's a quadrilogy at present, so it'd be four books. Pretty detailed notes. I wrote a short story called To Find a Peach, which was in an anthology called The Wand That Rocks the Cradle. And it's essentially a version of what is chapter one of the first book. It's a little different than what will ultimately be in there, but that's what it is. And so I'm getting closer and closer to diving into that series. And you know, I grew up on fantasy and sci-fi, so I want to get back into it. I love it. But on the sci-fi, I just finished a short novel by science fiction standards. Well, by any standards, actually, it's just over 40,000. So it's a novella, pretty much, called Kemper's House, that's involves like a first contact sort of story and some time dilation issues and the grand scope of history sort of a question. And it's one of these things where a group of astronauts is sent to, you know, 300 light years away to make first contact. And so what happens when they get there? What happens when they're there? What happens when they return? And boy, that was a lot of fun for me. It was a lot of fun to explore these scientific ideas and to, you know, to write a little bit gritty, you know. I mean, I don't get too far from that. And the same won't be true of the fantasies. They'll be, you know, more Martin than Tolkien, you know, in terms of grittiness. But it's just such a different kind of story than crime fiction. And so I've really enjoyed diving into that.
Do you like fantasy or sci-fi, Jack?
Yeah, I think the most interesting part of all of that is oftentimes the world building.
Yeah.
That's like one of the most entertaining things is people love making, you know, maps for all their places and all mm-hmm. their, mm-hmm. you know, stories. I think world building is like one of my favorite aspects of that, you know? So that's really cool.
I like how world building is done in a show don't tell fashion as well. I don't like the first three chapters are going to be expository world building chapters. You know, the person's going to go to market and buy some fruit and that's it. You know, that's all that happens. I mean, I sound like a hypocrite now because that's exactly what happens in the first chapter, but there's more to it than that. And there's more stuff going on and it's a lot more exciting than that. It's not just traipsing through the market and learning that the different races are and the, I mean, it's almost like the tutorial level in a fantasy role-playing game or something. And I don't like that. I like how, like, I'm a big fan of the Joe Abercrombie series, the First Law series, and his world building is massive. There's a massive amount of world building. I mean, YouTube channels that focus on Game of Thrones and The Witcher and Tolkien include Abercrombie when they talk about, like, in Deep Geek and, you know, different channels like this. They talk about Abercrombie as well because it's such a deep lore. But you get almost all of it just by the fact that these characters are living in it. And so you piece it all together because of what the characters experience and what they do and what they see, as opposed to this, you know, huge exposition. And so I like that kind of world building because you're discovering it almost as if you were transported there and have to discover it through experience rather than reading a travel brochure.
Man, that was Tolkien's downfall, in my opinion. I mean, not everyone would agree, but when you just read the 8,000 pages of him describing a walk in the park to no, you know, real, I want to say destination, where you go put it in the movie and you can make it a flower. And maybe you could spend a little time looking in on the flower, but yeah, I think in word form in books, that's where a lot of fantasy ends up always getting, you know, stuck right at the beginning. And, you know, I just finished Mass Effect 1 and I just started Mass Effect 2 today. And it's kind of like, you know, you're finally learning how to pick up a gun and find your inventory and all that stuff. And it's like, you know, I want to go see him blow up a mountain. I don't want to learn, you know, where the market is, but you have to. And so that's where the beginning of that can always be slow, but it's fun eventually, you know. It's the vegetables before you can have dessert.
Really kind of is. That's a great series, Mass Effect. and fun to play, great lore. I really enjoyed that. And the original ending got a lot of hate, but they patched it a little bit and made it a little more palatable. But, you know, the thing about a book or a movie or a game, you know, the ending matters, but it's also about the journey, and a video game especially. I mean, if you play 20 to 40 to 60 hours and you don't like the last 30 minutes when the game ends, you know, that sucks, but you still got 49 and a half hours of real enjoyment, you know? So I think people lose sight of that sometimes, even though I'm a huge proponent of good storytelling, don't get me wrong. But, you know, a bad ending for a book is a lot more devastating, I think, than a video game or even a movie sometimes.
I think you could take that another level to series, whether it's a TV series.
Oh, yeah.
And I hadn't thought to go this way, but wrapping it around to your A Grifter song. I mean, how challenging was it to come up with an ending to a 36-book series, 30 stories of which you did not write, and have readers come away with a sense of, I guess, what were you aiming for? Closure? I, for one, was not satisfied as one of your readers. Closure is a good word.
Well, yeah, that's a tough one, because there's so many ways you can go with something like that. And as I did interviews with each of the other 29 authors, yourself included, everybody kind of gave their best guess as to what I was going to do. And more interestingly, their opinion on what they would do or what they would like to see. And those opinions and those ideas varied radically from person to person. Everything from the, you know, the Hallmark happy ending to everybody dies in the nuclear explosion, you know, and everything in between. And I think that's a testament to how people bring their own, you know, their own artistic bent to bear on a series like that. And it was really cool in that respect. So it was tough. I had to think for a long time what's a realistic ending that I would be satisfied with. And I guess, as selfish as it sounds, I think when I got to the end of it, I knew I had to write a story that I would be satisfied with the ending, and I couldn't worry about whether you were or someone else was or not, because you have to stay true to your own artistic vision for something like that. And so I always knew that it was going to have a certain tone to it. And then I kicked around a couple of different possibilities, but it was tough because you feel the weight of all those previous 34 stories and you want to do them justice, and you don't want to, because how many shows or books have you read that the ending was disappointing? You know,
how many times have you ranted about the ending of a TV series?
I mean, not a TV series, but the amount of mysteries in our seasons that I've fake yelled at authors for doing something that annoyed me, even if it was totally justified. A lot of times it's more, I didn't predict that would happen, and then they did it, and I'm mad that they tricked me. You did that to me in the episode that is, you know, linked with this that just dropped. I'm quite mad, by the way. I hope you know that. And you will see how mad I am when you listen to this episode.
I'll look forward to it then. Uh-huh. You know, the thing about it is, Jack, is you wouldn't be mad if you didn't care a little bit. So that makes me
happy. That's the problem. I care way too much. I get invested in characters that half the time have this huge background that I have no idea about. You know, your character, Steph, I've never heard of him. You know, there's a few times in the story where there's clearly something that's already been explained that I have no idea about, but now I love him. And then you get to the end and you just, you know, you're rooting for this guy that you've only known for like an hour, you know, and that's kind of what happens in movies. You root for a person you've only known for an hour, unless, you know, it's a actor that you're following and you like, but yeah.
Well, if you remember, I don't remember which season it was. It might've been 5. When Frank wrote the Hiawatha story.
The dying word or last word.
The last, that was 4, A Word Before Dying.
There you
and
go.
The word was Hiawatha. And I think it's okay to talk about this. People, as you said, it's the journey. So if you want to go back and listen to the episode, you'll just have a little edge over other listeners.
Or spoiler alert. How about that? Spoiler alert.
Skip forward in the timeline 2 minutes.
Well, the interesting thing, I don't know, Jack, how much you remember that in detail, but you set up a moral dilemma. you know, it wasn't so much in the end about whether the father was killed or not killed. The question was whether it was right or wrong to hide from a nephew that he could be a candidate for a higher amount of inheritance, but he was a drug addict. And the cousin's slash, you know, executor made the decision to hide it because she wanted to keep him alive. And so it really set up this very interesting moral, and I guess it would depend on whether, you know, what you valued more, on whether you say, wow, she did the right thing, or like, no, she didn't. Do you remember that story?
I do. I think I got it wrong. I think that's what I remember. That's what I remember most about most stories is how mad I was at the end. If I was mad, I got it wrong.
Well, you got it wrong, but I thought we had this really cool conversation about, yeah, it's a really good question of if you know that giving somebody something, even if they have, you know, or otherwise do it, but it means that they're going to very likely overdose or in some other way kill themselves, is giving them what they've earned the right thing to do?
I think my argument is that you can be broke in a druggie just as easy as you can be rich in a druggie. So I think that's what a lot of rock stars have taught me. That's what The Dirt, the movie about Motley Crue, that's what that taught me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So that's a good question for someone who, you know, is older than 20 years old, maybe.
Well, and the other part of that is what's the right decision, but also who has the right to decide that? Do you even have the right to decide that? Or do you have the duty to decide that and you can't shirk it? I mean, there's a lot of questions that come up there. And, you know, it's no gone, baby, gone. But I like that sort of quandary where a right answer is also a wrong answer. And there, you know, and it does, it depends on how you look at it. And there's a cost no matter what. Those are very human and very real. I mean, how often in life is there truly a black and white decision? I mean, it's not all the time. There's usually nuance there. There's cost. There's weighing out and balancing, you know, what various factors and outcomes, and we do the best that we can, right? But it's to me, those are interesting decisions. And the one that you're referencing was an interesting decision. To say again, that even whether the sister and or the daughter of the deceased and Steph, because he knew about it, do they have the right to make that decision? Do they have the duty to make that decision? Do they, you know, is it ethically required of them? Or can they say, hey, let the law handle it. The law is the law. I mean, there's so many different philosophies that picking the philosophy and applying it comes up with a different answer to those kinds of questions. And at the core of it all, you have a very human dilemma. You have, you know, somebody's livelihood, their health, their life even, you know, at stake. And so those kinds of questions interest me, especially when they're not cut and dried. And a lot of my work, you'll find things like that, and not just the Copriva series, but across all of my work. I mean, including the fantasy and the sci-fi even. I mean, I can't get away from it. It's the things that interest me. I don't do as well with the, you know, black hats and white hats don't work for me very well.
Oh, yeah, I get that. I've always thought it as a very artsy question about one or the other. Both have their negatives, both have their positives. I think those are what have created some of the greatest pop culture, you know, whether it be films or books, you know. So I definitely agree with that philosophy. I've actually always liked the idea of a choose your own adventure book for that sole fact of you let the, I don't want to make that decision. Truthfully, I don't want to make it. I'll let the reader make it. They can figure it out. I'm not going to put myself, because writing that question is you pose yourself an unnecessarily hard question. I wrote it. Why do I have to answer? I'm going to make someone else do it. They're paying for this book. They're paying to listen to this, or they're listening to it for free or something. They should make it, not me.
I loved those choose your own adventure books when I was a kid. They're great. I didn't realize they were still a thing.
They are. Yeah. I would like to try to write one. I think they'd be very challenging to write.
Well, I think they still exist in the medium of video games. I mean, that's essentially a choose your own adventure, right? And I've thought about trying to, you know, what it would be like to write a video game, you know, with an overarching narrative, you know, like a role-playing game. And the reality is, I mean, you're writing multiple books because of multiple paths that, you know, I mean, just the one you're playing now, Mass Effect, there's so many choices that the choices have impact. And, unlike some games, they actually do have an impact. And so you have to write for those eventualities and possibilities, and some can be very divergent from one another. And so I think it'd be tough, but I certainly enjoyed reading. If yes, turn to page 42. If no, turn to page 96.
Yeah.
Well, this has been an amazing conversation. I can't believe how much territory we've covered. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what you're actively working on right now?
Well, I'm working on a few things. I'm working on a short story called Dare or Truth. That will be coming to you for your second half of your season on Murder to Die For. And then I've written the fifth Stefan Kopriva book. It's called, awesome. It's called Think of Laura. It's first draft finished, waiting for second draft. And currently I'm doing an edit of book six in the Charlie 316 series that I write with Colin Conway. This one's called The Silence of the Dead.
Good title.
Yeah, it's from a Edgar Lee Masters poem called Silence. It's the final from the final stanza, and it takes place. I mean, it ostensibly in the present. It takes place after the fifth book in the series, but that's kind of the tentpole chapters. The bulk of it takes place in 51, 74, and 05. And so a character is delving back into some cold cases and talking to someone. And so you get these three different time periods. It's sort of a generational mystery, generational crime that is being solved by three different sets of detectives over that time period. And it's pretty ambitious. It's pretty long. It's pretty convoluted in terms of, from a writing standpoint, you know, a lot of cats to try to herd. But it's been really fun. And it is a complicated enough book that I think I'm grateful that it's a collaboration that Colin and I are working on it together, because stuff that I miss, he'll catch, and vice versa. I'm pretty excited about that. It should be out in 2024. And then of course, I'll be working on the next River City book soon.
That is a lot to keep you busy.
For sure. For sure.
So with that, I guess we'll wrap up with a little non-Zafiro moment. Hop over to our podcast, Mysteries to Die For. You can find it on Apple, wherever you get your podcasts. And then episode 6 is A Checkered Past. It is a two-part, A and B. Then stick around for the rest of the season. All of the stories are themed around games people play. And then we have the anthologies that come out to support that. So the anthology for the first one, Opening Gambit, came out in March 2024. So that's on bookshelves now. And then the second half, which I believe will be called Final Move, will be out in September 2024. So check us out. Give us a review. Tell mystery lovers about us. And yeah, check out all of Frank's work on our show. Well, Frank, thank you for being a guest on your own show.
Well, it was fun. You had some great questions. I really enjoyed the conversation. I'm glad you guys were able to be like Vikings and storm the studio and take over. And you were very polite, Vikings. So thank you for that. You won't be here next episode. I'll be back next episode next month with interviews conducted at the Left Coast Crime Mystery Conference in Seattle, Washington. So hear a lot of short interviews from a bunch of different authors. And who knows, you might find a new candidate for Murder to Die For or season 8.
Awesome. We'll line them up to invite. Well, with that, this is TG Wolf and Jack Wolf thanking you for joining us today. And a reminder that sometimes you need to be in the wrong place to write crime.